from the Gothic Quarter in Barcelona. This is Market Movers, the podcast that gives you a closer look at the financial markets to trade responsibly. Here are your hosts, Lior Cohen and Yochai Elam.
Hello and welcome. Thank you for joining us and clicking the subscribe button. I'm your co-host, Lior Cohen, and joining me, much like the dude, he also abides, Yochai Elam. How's it going, Yochai?
Hi, Lior. I'm doing great. How are you doing? I'm abiding here, yeah.
Yeah, you're abiding all the way in Barcelona, and the weather is fine, right?
Yeah, the sun is shining, no rain, no pain.
A lot of market volatility, and that's always good for us.
Yeah, yeah, it's been, we had some mad weeks so far, and it has calmed down just a bit, but I think it's just the calm before the next storm, and we'll talk about the next storm soon.
Yeah, we have a lot of on the agenda today, and today we're going to talk about Bitcoin. Is it the new gold? And we'll preview the FOMC's next meeting, and finally we'll conclude with China's GDP. Where is the China economy is heading and how they'll impact the other relating economies. But first, Bitcoin. It had a lot of volatilities beginning of this year, and with all the commotion over Bitcoin rising to over hovering over $1,000, then crashing down, and now it's around $350.
Oh, not too shabby.
Yeah, not too shabby. Close to $400, and it had a lot of volatility, especially surrounding Mt. Gox's demise, if you will. Let's kick it off. Is it actually a commodity? Is it a currency? Is it a service? In order to better assess if whether or not this is the new gold, we have to first tackle this question of whether or not it's commodity or not. What's your thought about it, Yochai?
Well, I can't see Bitcoin as a commodity because it's not something physical you can actually hold. So that sort of away from my definition of a commodity.
So if you cannot hold it, it's not a commodity. That's your point.
It seems like another investment tool, another financial instrument, which can go up and down and can disappear one day or can make you millions. So it's just like any other speculation, like an ETF, like anything else.
Oh, okay. And for me, on the other hand, I think it's more of a more in line of a commodity. And I'll tell you why. Well, first, when you look at Bitcoin, you have to look at it as something that has a price, and it's most of this price is held off on the belief of people that want to use it as a service. As you said, it says it has people use it in order to make payments online, of course. It has its ups and downs. Most of it is relies on whether or not people want to use it and believe in it. When they believe in it, as we saw it the last month of last year, suddenly they had some sharp volatility. And in that sense, when it comes to volatility, it has some parallels to other commodities.
Yeah, but volatility has been quite extreme in Bitcoin. And for me, that's a sign that it isn't yet a mature commodity or a mature financial instrument, no?
Oh, yeah. Don't get me wrong. I don't think that it's still up there when it comes to commodity. I think that it's not a gold. It is a commodity, but it doesn't have the same assurance as you have with gold, with all, of course, the problems that we have with gold. So let's start with answering a few questions. So does it have an intrinsic value? I mean, does it have an underlying value? This is something that is backed by more than just market expectations and belief. And in other words, does it have a bottom price where you say, okay, even if people don't believe in it, it'll still have some use other than just people believing that it has some value. So if we look at it at gold, so we see that, yeah, people believe in it now, and they believed in it much more back in 2013 when it was around 1700s, and even further down the line, people felt that it's going to go to 2000 and even higher than that. It still has a value. It still has that you can still use it to make pretty shiny things and use some maybe a little bit industrial applications and teeth fillings, and you can improve your teeth by filling it up with gold. That's always been a...
Yeah, you can always escape with some gold in your pockets and in your teeth.
Exactly, yeah. And it has a little bit of a comeback back in the US. I know that some people used to put like grills, gold grills, and My friend also did it. So yeah, they have that. That's one application that you can have, and that's the bottom price for it. If everybody don't believe in gold and start saying, oh, we don't believe it as a something that we want to hold on for investment purposes, we'll still have it as something to put to use for industrial applications a little bit, and mostly for jewelry, teeth, these kind of things. On the other hand, we also have to look at it. So how about the US dollar? We know that the US dollar, obviously the leading currency in the world, is the Bitcoin more in line like a currency? Is it more something that will be a substitute for people than holding US dollar? Does it have any intrinsic value over there, US dollar?
Well, it also depends on trust. If people trust in its value, it has a value. It's not a commodity, it's a currency. So I think like Bitcoin.
Yeah, you're right. And when it comes to a currency, the US dollar also, we have to remember that the Fed is still the one issuing the US dollars. US citizens still have a use, even if people won't have much of a belief in the US dollar. They can still pay taxes with them. That's something that, you know,
yeah.
We cannot put a lot of value in that, of course, but
yeah, it comes down to paying taxes. So if you can't pay taxes in US dollars, they're worth something, right?
Yeah, there you go. It's worth paying it. I mean, look at me. I'm in Argentina. I'm still paying my taxes in Israel in the local currency.
Right.
I don't use the Israeli shekel, but I'm forced to use it to pay my taxes. So there is that value to consider. So, okay, so let's take it another route. Maybe it's just PayPal. And in a way, I think it has some similarities to PayPal, because it does have a provide a service of online payments.
Right, you can pay with it.
Yeah, you can pay with it. But on the other hand, we have to remember that PayPal is also still uses real currency. As such, it provides more of a service, but still, Bitcoin is still by its own a price and doesn't use other currencies. So another issue to consider is it safe? Is it safe to use? Is it safe to store? The answer is yes and no. When you look at Bitcoin, we look at the safety of its code, and yeah, that's very safe. Nobody has doubts about that.
Yeah, even the US Marshals had some trouble with using and selling the Bitcoins they managed to confiscate. So if these guys, the best agencies in the world have a hard time in understanding it, so
yeah,
I guess it is quite safe, no? At the moment.
Yeah, it's really safe, but we still have to remember that you're as strong as the weakest link. If the weak security that was in Mt. Gox still put into question that if Bitcoin is very safe and nobody doubts about that, when it comes to its code, it's still as safe as the links around process of holding Bitcoin.
Yeah, so if a company goes rogue, you're in trouble. But that's the same thing for every bank, isn't it? If you hold a hard currency, if you hold the Deutschmark, which was considered a very safe currency, or any other strong currency in the bank, if the bank goes bankrupt, your money's gone.
That's right. But then we have to put into account the funds. So do you have the sufficient funds to support a level security? And that's a little bit more questionable, because if you're the CME, the New York Stock Exchange, you have a little bit more funds than trading platforms for Bitcoin. So we have that. Of course, it doesn't mean that funds equal more less scams. Look at PayPal. It had some security issues in the past, and this is a company that brought in $6.6 billion last year. I won't go on too much of a tangent, but look at what happened to Apple with all the celebrity picks. I mean,
yeah,
they have a lot of security. What's with that security? They have a lot of this is the second largest company in the world.
Yeah, and the same things happened to Kmart and Sears and Target. I hope I'm not mistaken with the names of the companies, but it's not that uncommon to have people's data compromised.
Yes, exactly. So the bottom line for me, at least, is I think they have some similarities when it comes to a currency. It resembles a little bit more of a commodity, for me at least, than a currency, and let alone a service. But the main problem for me, at least, that Bitcoin doesn't have underlying value, much like other commodities when it comes to oil, natural gas, gold. They have uses, they have applications. So even if in the virtual world, if you will, people won't have value for it, in the real world, they'll still have some a use for these commodities. And for Bitcoin, it all falls down on whether people think that continue to have value and it's priced at $400 or $900 next year. I think it's more in line of a commodity, but without people believing in it, it's not going to be there.
Right. It's all about trust.
Yes. And I remember you talking about that. You said also that the governments have some issues with that. So that's another issue that will also impact its price, whether or not governments believe in it or not, right?
Right. So if governments try to regulate it too much or shut it down or make it extinct, I don't know if they'll make it, but they'll sure curb its popularity and hit it. I mean, if they portray a picture of it being unsafe. On the other hand, if governments adopt it as a way of payment, or more companies adopt it as a way of payment, then it will gain traction and will rise in value. So if companies and governments put trust in it, yeah, the value will rise. If they'll ignore it or hit it hard, the value will fall. And that's quite similar to any other type of commodity, stock, bond, or anything else, no?
Yes, I remember that when the US Senate had a hearing, just a hearing about maybe considering Bitcoin as an acceptable currency, of course, the price jumped over the roof. And
yeah, because it became mainstream.
Yeah, because suddenly, it is considered, you know, it's in the, somebody's just considering you, and already people jumped the bandwagon and started purchasing Bitcoin and saying, it's gonna be very valuable one day.
Yeah, once it becomes a household name, then it gains traction, the value rises.
Yes, and also we have to remember that I think it gained a lot of traction mainly after the economic collapse, when the Fed started to pumping more money into the system, and the low interest rates, and people mistrusting the direction of the central banks, and saying, that's also provided the environment for gold to reach such high levels back in 2011, 2012. And I think this was in line also with the development of Bitcoin, that provided an alternative for people to use for their currency that they have in their country. And I think also when I come over here in Argentina, for instance, you see there's a lot of growing interest in Bitcoin, mainly because people are believing less in the Argentinian peso. I think that for countries that have such problems with their currency and the belief in their local currency, just like in you see in Venezuela, also you see in Argentina, maybe Brazil a little bit, and I think that these issues also help push up the demand for Bitcoin. So
yeah, when trust in currencies goes down, trust in Bitcoin goes up. No,
we'll have to see whether or not it will survive once the Fed start raising interest rates and maybe gaining a little bit more people's trust, and maybe, you know, and we see gold also coming slowly down. And let's switch from Bitcoin. Let's switch to the Fed. We have a lot of news items related to the Fed. We had a little bit of a change in heart, maybe from James Bullard. Suddenly he opened up the door for maybe QE3 not concluding in this upcoming meeting.
Yeah, he went up in this TV interview. Nobody expected it. Everybody was sure that QE is going to end in October, and the Fed said it quite a few times in the past. And he said that he would suggest to continue QE to invoke this clause of the Fed being data dependent, and because of lower inflation expectations and worries about the Eurozone, to continue QE at a pace of $15 billion per month, to continue it until things look better. And that was a big bomb that Bullard dropped. Usually Bullard is bullish, optimistic, and this time he was a bit pessimistic, even though he said the US economy is doing well. So stock markets went back up, so did oil, the dollar went down, because when a hawk goes dovish, the doves celebrate.
That sounds like love song, when a hawk going dovish.
Yeah, that reminds me of some song, when doves cry, that's a song by Prince, right? So in this case, doves were happy. But in that sort of stabilized the tantrum, the second taper tantrum, if you wish. I mean, the worries about the Eurozone, oil, global demand, China, we'll talk about it later. So that managed to stabilize markets. But I don't think at all that the Fed is going to refrain from ending QE. I think that on October 29th, we're going to hear the official announcement, as expected, about the end of QE.
So Yellen is not going to be impressed by Bullard bullying the Bloomberg TV guy and saying, we maybe heard the last taper won't be a taper and keep it as an open-end QE3 for the coming months.
Yeah, and here are five reasons why I think all these doubts will be removed on October 29th. So we had other FOMC members, doves, that went hawkish. So these doves maybe did cry, like Prince said. So Rosengren and Williams, comes from the San Francisco Fed, where Yellen used to be a president, and they do support the end of QE. They said it after Bullard spoke. They said it on Sunday and Monday in various interviews. It's also important to remember that last time there were two hawkish dissenters. So how could Bullard and Yellen, let's say she sides with Bullard, how can they convince the whole FOMC to continue QE? Once again, I don't think so. And there are other reasons. Well, like most central banks, second reason is inflation. They have an inflation target. We have last core PC index, what the Fed does care about, and it's at a healthy 1.5%. It's not very exciting. It's not going wild, but it's not under 1% like we've seen it in the past.
But you, when you look at the core PC, you're right that it's currently around 1.5%, not too impressive, but still a little bit below target. But also what Bullard also referred to is to the inflation expectations over the coming years, and he said it's also around 1.5%. So that's another thing that maybe also considering not only the current inflation, but the trailing inflation, but also the expectations, which are a little bit lower than the FOMC's target.
Yeah.
If they have a target of 2% and they are still at 1.5%, then what's the point of having a target to begin with?
Well, having a target is important, but inflation expectations can be described in various ways. Nobody knows the future, of course, and the Fed can try to be also ahead of the curve. And okay, even if inflation expectations are lower and oil prices are falling, and that also implies lower inflation expectations, we do have strong jobs in the US, and in my opinion that implies that wages will eventually rise. So average hourly earnings are currently rising at a pace of 2%, but we have excellent employment numbers that the Fed is looking at. Last figures, non-farm payrolls was a nice gain of 248,000, and good revisions to previous month that raised doubts. The JOLTS figure is at the highest level since 2001. It's the job openings that the Fed eyes, and jobless claims fell to the lowest level since 2000, and it isn't a one-off. It's also the moving average is also standing at that point.
So yeah, okay. So I understand that we have, on the one hand, we have when you look in the labor market, if we very crudely divide it to one, the number of employees and number of people that are wanting to work, and the number of open jobs, it's looking good and it has some progress. But on the other hand, when we look at the wages in the labor market, they're slowly crawling up at 2%. Not too impressive, but not too bad as well. When you look at the inflation, yeah, it's 1.5%, and it could be a little bit even a little bit farther down if other major economies, Europe, China, Brazil, if there are continued slowdown, especially in 2015, 2016, this could have some adverse impact on the US economy, not only on inflation, but also on the labor market. So we have that uncertainty. And and when Bullard said it, just, you know, it's QE3 now, it's at 15 billion. It's not a big number. It's not something that will have reaction to the markets, will have such an impact on the markets, but it will at least keep it open for a raising a QE3 again if they'll see that there is some change the FOMC's outlook. So don't you think that's something more prudent?
Yeah, well, that's right. If you keep QE open, it's easier to enlarge it if needed than restarting it from scratch. That's right. But the Fed already has a 0% interest rate for a long time, and it does have a clause in the FOMC statement saying it'll remain for a considerable time at these extremely low levels. So I think the Fed could just keep interest rates low without pouring more money, buying more dollars. And if you mentioned beforehand worries about global growth, they're currently focused in Europe. So if you really care about Europe, if the Fed is really worried about European growth, one way to tackle it is not to buy more bonds, not to print more dollars. And if the Fed stops printing more dollars, it'll also help the euro fall. And this will encourage the European economies in terms of exports and fighting inflation, etc. So I think what I see in Bullard, and it's what many critics say about the Fed, is that the Fed is sometimes seen as working for Wall Street. And in this case, we had a slide in stocks, sort of a global storm. And Bullard immediately jumped and said, okay, we can keep QE. Don't worry, don't worry. So I think that if the Fed wants to keep its credibility, to keep its trust, like we talked before about Bitcoin, it should continue as planned, respond to the data in the United States, which is very strong, and QE as planned. It can hold off raising interest rates for maybe a longer time. It has no commitment around that. It can extend it or cut it short. But now doing a step of continuing QE, I think, would erode its credibility. And that's the last reason I think that the Fed will end QE in October.
So circling back to Bitcoin, it all comes down to credibility. So if suddenly Yenel will flip-flop and say, and after saying every meeting, yeah, we're going to end in October, then suddenly flips-flops on it, yeah, that's something that will have more of an adverse impact on her credibility and the FOMC's credibility as a whole. And this is something that have more adverse impact than actually just rebooting QE3 or let's say QE4 if suddenly things go sour and the outlook has shifted significantly.
Yeah, credibility is the strongest tool that the Fed has. The Fed has a lot of impact on markets and it wouldn't like to erode it. And I think it can respond to a change in US data, but US data clearly points to the end of QE.
And speaking of US data, we have on when the FOMC is convening and releasing its data, we have another big report coming out, right?
Yeah, the same day we have the first release of GDP growth for the third quarter. I don't have the estimates yet, but the official estimates, I see them at around somewhere between 2.5% to 3%. Data so far for the third quarter was pretty good. The Fed will probably get it before the meeting, so it'll have enough time to digest it. They might get it, they have a two-day meeting, they might get it 2-3 days before it's released to the public. One thing to consider. Another thing to consider is that we have the core PCE price index on Friday, October 31st, 2 days after the meeting. And also here, I think there is a chance that the Fed will see it beforehand. So we can use the Fed decision to perhaps trade on the core PCE price index. I mean, if we have something relatively hawkish, we can assume that it's on the rise. And if we have something relatively dovish, I think it's going to be low. Regarding the dovish and the hawkish, so I think that Fed will end QE. I'll be very surprised if they don't. And the focus, I believe, will be on the phrase considerable time.
The good old considerable time phrase that will never end. So whether or not, this is also a question, right? Whether or not we'll end it this time.
Yeah, and I think because of all these worries, because of Bullard, because all the things that are inflation expectations, I think they will leave it intact. Another reason to leave it is because there's no press conference this time. So if removing the considerable time phrase will be a significant hint that the Fed is about to raise the rates. And I think that Yellen will do it only when there is a press conference around it where she can explain more in detail. And since there's no press conference in this October meeting, I think they'll do all they can not to rock the boat. And so I believe a considerable time will stay. So currently considerable time is tied to the end of QE. So they'll just remove this correlation to QE and say considerable time until they raise the interest rates and that's it. Leave the market hanging and depending on the data.
So you say that basically we're not going to see a lot of fireworks coming the end of October. It's going to be pretty smooth sailings, business as usual, QE3 ends, considerable time it remains in.
Exactly.
All right.
Yeah, one more thing about Bullard that maybe makes my opinion weaker, but it's important to note it still, that just before the non-farm payrolls, he came out with a speech. It was a planned speech, but he did say the unemployment rate in September is impressive or something or along these lines. And indeed, the NFP report was great and the unemployment rate fell below 6%. Now, also, President Obama said something like that. I mean, he was very bullish on the US economy one day before the non-farm payrolls. So they both gave us a hint. But I'm not sure that this time Bullard is correct. And I don't think he'll manage to sway other members with him.
All right. So we'll have to wait and see for that. So that'll be an interesting weekend to view. And you talked about economic outlook and, of course, the progress we said about Europe and China. And let's go back to China. We have we had the GDP reports that were released. So how did China do?
Well, China is the world's second largest economy after the US, of course, and it reported a growth rate of 7.3%, just 0.1% above expectations of 7.2%. But still lower than the 7.5 target set by the Chinese government. So they can tolerate, of course, a lower number. Many suspect that these numbers are always engineered by the central government, engineered to their direction.
So they couldn't engineer it to be more right on target at 7.5% at least, you know?
Yeah.
It would have been such a problem to engineer it, so that way.
Yeah, it's just use the backspace and then hit the 5 number and that's it. That's all the engineering that needs to be done, basically.
Yeah, they couldn't done it that way. I mean, it's... well, maybe they wanted to be more reliable, you know? Just like when you're cheating on the test, you don't want it to be an actual 100. You don't want it to be an A+, because it will be more suspicious if you're an F student. So you'll do it like a C+, or something like that. So maybe that's what they're aiming for.
Yeah, you have to plant some mistakes along the way. And I think they can also get criticism. I mean, they're monitored for electricity usage, rail cargo, and other sort of other indicators such as the volumes at ports and things like that. So I don't think they can really engineer it too far. Anyway, it does serve their interest, this kind of number. It shows that China is slowing down in a controlled manner, a soft landing from the extremely strong growth. And on the other hand, industrial production went up to an annual pace of 8%. Last time it was 6.9 or 6.8. It was quite scary. So the good news from here is that everything is under control, or at least China engineers it to look that way. The bad thing is that it's not strong enough to be reassuring for global growth, and not bad enough for more stimulus to be introduced by the Chinese government. So that's actually bad news. They will do only kind of small stimulus, like changing the reserve ratio rate in some banks, or lend some help, or do very local, very pinpointed stuff. Okay, so all in all, this Goldilocks number of 7.3% is okay, but it's, on one hand, it's not bad enough for new stimulus, and it's not good enough for reassuring the world that everything is okay. So for Australia, it's not good news, because iron ore demand is going to slow down, and for Germany, it means less infrastructure projects, which it doesn't China, and it's also bad news for US politicians that say that China is a currency manipulator. But I think that this engineering of more consumption, internal growth, and less external investment growth is all in all good in the long run. This China cannot carry the baton for a really long time. It did it after the financial crisis. Now it's turn of the United States. Can the United States pull the whole world forward? This is really, really an open question. We'll hear more about it from the Fed, I guess, next week.
Okay, so all relies on the Fed. So, okay, that's it for now. Thank you all for listening. Thank you, Hi, as usual.
Thank you, Lior. We're expecting turbulent times ahead.
Yeah, that's cool. And if you like our show, give us a 5-star rating on iTunes. You can subscribe through the iTunes, Stitcher, email, RSS, or wherever suits you fancy. So until next week, this is Lior signing off for Yochai, saying have a great week and invest responsibly.
For comments, suggestions, and questions, visit the podcast page at forexcrunch.com or tradingnrg.com, where you can also find past episodes and subscribe to the show. Our listeners make Market Movers possible.